The following program will make you want to grow things and experience new and wonderful dreams about your plants, garden, and garden design. Listener participation is strongly advised. Welcome to Down the Garden Path with your host, Joanne Shaw, right here on Reality Radio 101. To contact Joanne live, email her right now, realityradio101@yahoo.com. And now, your host of Down the Garden Path, Joanne Shaw.
Thank you, and welcome to Down the Garden Path, where we talk about down-to-earth practical advice on everything plants, garden, and landscape design. Hello, Gary.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Our plants are doing well in the studio, thank you.
Excellent. Oh, it's still doing well. That's good.
Yeah. I didn't check it today for
no,
water.
No, that's okay. Elaine is dead. She's taking care of it. So, okay. Yeah, between Elaine and I, we've got it under control.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, I can't wait to spring.
Yes, I know. Well, that's what I was just going to say. Well, it's February, and we are currently covered in snow here in southern Ontario.
Yeah.
And just the positive side is all the plants have a nice cozy blanket covering them.
And that's good?
That is good.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That prevents them from the dry and cold winds. It keeps them unbelievably, it seems odd to say they're warm under the snow, but it's good for them. And all that moisture when it melts is also good for them.
Good.
So what better time to start thinking about gardening is when we're covered in snow and it's all white outside.
Very nice.
And I promised you more on native plants. Really, really looking forward to...
Now, we're not talking about plants from, like, Africa and stuff like that. All right, because people are saying, I see you're doing this show on native plants.
And they're
that's what they're assuming. I don't know.
No, native to our zone, our planting zone in our area. And so I promised you more on native plants, and I'm really excited to learn more myself. So my guest today is Miles McKenzie. He is a landscape architect and planting designer based in Toronto. His professional work includes design of sustainable landscapes that range from large urban waterfront parks to private residential properties. He is an avid native plant gardener and advocate for native trees and plants in everyday situations, which is really good to hear for my listeners.
Mm-hmm.
Miles is currently director at the North American Native Plant Society, which I'm looking forward to learning more about as well. It is a charitable organization that promotes native plant preservation and restoration, and he believes that nature belongs in urban, suburban, and rural areas as much as in remote, wild areas. So, welcome to my guest, Miles.
Hi there.
How was that for an intro?
That was great. It was probably too good.
Well, it should be. So welcome to the show. I've been, like I said, I have been looking forward to learning more about native plants. As a landscape designer, I know I have a few of them in my toolbox, but I'm really looking forward to your suggestions on how we can help our listeners and my customers use them more often.
That would be great.
Yeah. So why don't we start off by you telling us why you think we should use native plants?
Well, it's a good question. There's certainly a lot of reasons to use native plants. For me, there's a few that are kind of at the top.
Okay.
And I guess firstly, you know, I think the big one is that native plants really, you know, when you use native plants, you really give our natural habitat a helping hand. So much of our natural environment, which includes, you know, songbirds, butterflies, bees, and more, has been lost because of, you know, a variety of human activities, whether it's, you know, our housing, our roads, our agriculture, and a lot of the natural habitats have really been lost, and with them those great parts of our wildlife. So, native gardening is really one way that you can change kind of the course of things a little bit.
Okay.
And it also, you know, one of the things that people may not realize as much is that what you do in the garden has a big impact as well. And, I think a lot of us have been, you know, quite comfortable over the last few decades of, you know, planting a lawn and maybe some ornamental plants. But I think what's really coming to light is that those lawns, which, you know, look so green, are actually pretty harmful. There's not a lot of life in them.
Yeah.
And the same goes with some of the plants that we commonly, you know, put at the edge of our lawn. It doesn't offer a lot.
And I think people forget how high maintenance a lawn is, considering
that,
you know, it doesn't give us the rewards aside from, you know, just the visual of a nice green lawn. It's a lot of work that doesn't really benefit, you know, the environment, really.
No, you end up spending, I mean, I hear people that basically get home from work and then they feel like they've got this other job in the summer where they're, you know, maintaining their lawn and
that's right.
putting fertilizers and mowing it and everything. And
yeah.
You know, it's not easy.
It's always funny. I find this the complaint circle of, you know, they water it, they fertilize it, and then, geez, they've got to go out and cut it. You know?
It grows.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, and I think we hear a lot about, you know, when urban sprawl kind of affects an area, we hear a lot about how it impacts, you know, things. I mean, I do things like the coyotes, you know, that they're coming encroaching, and things like people having problems with rabbits. But they often do forget about birds and butterflies and bees. I think they kind of they just fall by the wayside, and the flowers and the gardens really impact those animals or those insects a lot more.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, I've been reading, you know, as I've become more and more interested in native plant gardening, I've been reading, you know, some of the science, you know, maybe not the really long studies, but, you know, some of the science that talks about how many bees and butterflies and birds there are in like a single big oak tree, as an example.
Really?
And it's really quite something where you look at, you know, there might be 5,000 species in one big tree.
Wow.
And then, you know, whereas another tree that's not native would potentially have less than 5% of those organisms. So it's a really big difference.
Really? And it shows you, yeah, because to most people, a tree is a tree.
Yeah, they kind of look the same.
Yes.
You know, what's the big difference? Yeah.
So can we make a dent by just adding some native plants to our gardens, or, you know, are we telling our listeners that their whole garden needs to be native?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I you know, there are certainly a lot of people who think native is like the only way.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would say, you know, frankly, one plant, you know, one native plant in the garden is really a great thing. And it's such an important first step. So there's no doubt more is better.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a big proponent of people starting small.
Yeah,
you need
that's
to
good.
Start and learn.
Yes.
So, you know, to start with you know, even a couple of plants and then learning about how they work and whether they're in the right locations. It's just like any kind of gardening. It's really a journey. So I think the best way to experiment is just get a few plants, try them out, and I think people end up falling in love with them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's good to know, because I think it is overwhelming to think that, you know, you've got to take out everything you've done, or even if you're starting, you know, if you're starting from scratch, you might not know as much about native plants. So you're feeling like you're starting in the unknown area. So that's good. And I agree. I think I'm noticing especially last year, I think the issue with the birds and the bees especially and somewhat the butterflies. Have made it to the non-gardeners. You know, some of my customers have said, you know, well, we should, you know, what would be good for the bees? What else could we add? So I think that campaign is really, well, it's not really an intentional that it's meant to be a campaign, right? It's because there really is an issue. So it's not the campaign for the sake of a campaign, but it's definitely an issue. And I know you were involved with the Got Milkweed campaign.
Yeah, that's right. NAMPS, or the North American Native Plant Society, partnered with the David Suzuki Foundation for this kind of nifty campaign, which I think was fun because it got people and families and kids all kind of excited, and really the basis of that and that actually was a campaign, but that campaign was to raise awareness and to show people that even one simple plant in their garden, in this case milkweed,
right,
can make a big difference. And so milkweed is the host food for monarch butterfly larvae,
right?
And so I think that's something that in the last few years, and I think with the help of that Got Milkweed campaign, people are starting to realize that, oh wow, if we don't have milkweed, we don't have monarch butterflies. And there are declines in the monarch butterfly population.
Yes.
So how can we change that? And you can do it in your garden.
Yeah. Yeah, and just so everybody's clear, so really milkweed is the only food, right, that the monarch butterfly larva, or caterpillar, I guess. It's a caterpillar at that point, right? I'm trying to think my biology. Eats. So really, like you said, if there's no milkweed, there's no more monarch butterfly.
Yeah, and the reason is that, in a lot of cases, insects are specialists. So they've evolved over time to have these kind of perfect, relationships with plants. And this has evolved over, literally millions of years. And so the relationship between monarchs and milkweed is very tight.
Yes.
And so, that's an interesting one because it's not as common to see something that's linked.
Yes.
But those two really are, and milkweed is something that was, generally everywhere. And I think, with agriculture, it's really pushed out a lot of the field flowers and plants,
right,
that are native.
And didn't communities? I know I had a girlfriend mention that she read that our community considered milkweed a noxious weed.
It certainly was.
And yes.
Because it was, it's one of those sort of ironies, I guess you could say, is that some of the ones that tended to do really well in nature actually ended up being a nuisance for us,
right?
And were targeted, and have actually suffered the most, which is kind of interesting. So, that's true. I think farmers and others were trying to get rid of it on roadsides and everything, but it's. The importance of it has really come to light recently.
Yeah, and I know it's now available in nurseries, especially native plant nurseries, whereas you couldn't buy it before. You had to kind of go and find it.
So
that's a good thing that we're now trying to promote planting it. And which brings me up to the other topic of the impression that many gardeners have, and people in general, that native plants are either messy or invasive. And I have to say, I'm a little guilty of the second, because I tend to be leery. My customers want low maintenance gardens. And if plants are invasive, that's high maintenance. So how can we, or what's your perspective on that?
Yeah, no, I can certainly understand that. Part of it is that there are some plants that do really well in our gardens and other places. Goldenrod, I think, is an example of something that spreads really quickly. And but I think part of your question, Joanne, is maybe break it up into two pieces.
Sure.
One is that I think you're right, the impression is out there, but I think one way to break free from that idea is to think about the garden in a different way.
Okay.
So first of all, I would say that if we think about it simply as an extension of the interior of our home, then quite often people are thinking about it as a place that needs to be, ordered,
yes,
clean,
mm-hmm,
maybe a bit sterile.
Yeah.
And, the garden can be a lot more than that. It can offer a lot more, and really it can be a mental break from all of that.
Yes,
it can be a
yeah.
kind of a mini vacation from the normal demands and constraints that we have. And so in that way, it's not really about messy or clean. It's about a very different experience.
Oh, that is a great point. I could definitely see myself saying that to some of my customers. Okay.
Yeah, it's just a sort of evolving our thinking around it, I think, is important. And on the flip side, though, that doesn't mean that the garden has to be this sort of wild chaos.
Right.
You know, there are so many different kinds of native garden looks and styles, and some of them are fairly, neutral. They're small plants, using small plants in organized ways. So I think it's also about choosing the style that's right for you.
Okay.
and the right plants,
yes.
the right size for your garden.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, both those things, like loosening up our image of what the backyard or the garden can be, but also knowing that there are a lot of different ways you can use native plants. It's not just the kind of wildflower meadow.
Right, right. I think that's everybody's, impression, unfortunately. But but I know I use several of the flowering dogwoods, for instance, and serviceberry, are as shrubs, and I quite like them. And I think they offer, many of my customers want that full season or at least three season of interest. And they offer that, right, by having the spring flower, berries in the summer for the birds, and gorgeous fall color. So they're great plants.
Are you finding with your customers that they're quite happy after they've seen those for a few seasons?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
I have them in my own garden. I have two, I'm east-facing, and I had two flower. I have a pagoda flowering dogwood, a pagoda dogwood, and Cornus cusa. And so I have lots of pictures of different stages of them, so they're kind of easy for me to suggest, right? So that's a good choice. And all right, well, I've got a few more questions for you, Miles, but we are going to take a short commercial break, and we'll be right back. You are listening to Down the Garden Path with Joanne Shaw on Reality Radio 101.
Do I stress you out? My sweater is on backwards and inside out, and you say, how?
Looking for a great place to go for excellent coffee and delicious treats? Come visit us at Three Steps Up Coffee House in Whitby. Our coffee is made with freshly ground free trade coffee beans that are brewed at just the right temperature for the ultimate coffee drinking experience. Try one of our mouth-watering handmade treats that allow you to enjoy a little slice of heaven. We offer hearty organic soups, such as butternut squash with toasted almonds and sweet potato, carrot, and ginger. There is something for everyone, from healthy salads to gourmet sandwiches and delectable chocolate treats. Contact us to find out more about our amazing catering services. Find us at 605 Brock Street North in Whitby, Ontario. Licensed under the Liquor Control Board of Ontario. Open Mondays to Saturdays, 9:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. Seating for private functions and events available. Contact us by phone at 905-430-7817 or check out our website at www.threestepsup.weebly.com. Three Steps Up Coffee House. Three steps up to a perfect cup. About your pet becoming bored at home alone or while you are at work? If you love your pets but don't have the time to walk and play with them, Corey Hamilton can help. Growing up with a never-ending passion for animals, Corey is up for any challenge to make your pet healthy, happy, and fun. With Corey's expertise, you'll never again have to worry about your pets being left home alone. Corey's company, Taking the Lead, we'll treat them like they are a part of our family. Animal enthusiast Corey Hamilton loves anything with fur, fins, and feathers. Combined with her degree in biochemistry, your pets are not just in for some fun and play, but their needs are being well understood. Skip the guilt and let your pets enjoy their lives while you are rest assured in yours. For more information, contact Corey at 905-697-2788. That's 905-697-2788. Or visit us at www.takingthelead.ca. Remember, happy pets make a happy home. The following program will make you want to grow things and experience new and wonderful dreams about your plants, garden, and garden design. Listener participation is always strongly advised. Welcome back to Down the Garden Path with your host, Joanne Shaw, right here on Reality Radio 101. To contact Joanne live right now, email her, realityradio101, at yahoo.com. And now, back to your host of Down the Garden Path, Joanne Shaw.
Thank you, and welcome back to Down the Garden Path. I'm here tonight with my guest, Miles McKenzie. How are you doing, Miles?
I'm doing great, Joanne.
Good. Good. Well, welcome back. And we were just talking about how we need to change our perspectives as far as native plants go in our yards. How are you noticing this shift in your work in the areas? I know I read your bio a little earlier, so you've got quite a range of projects as a landscaped architect that you're working on. Are you seeing the pendulum swing?
I really am. Yeah,
excellent.
It's, I do different kinds of projects, as you say, and part of my work as a landscape architect is working with cities and towns to improve parks and school grounds and some of the streetscapes. And these clients, they're actually not only requesting the use of native plants, but they're more and more mandating it.
Really?
Yeah, and it's relatively new, but I would say in the last few years there are a lot of projects where I'm actually, being told that this is a requirement of the project. And I think it's, part of that's because they know, they've kind of read the science, they know how important native plants are to the environment.
Right.
But also, native plants in general often use less water and require less maintenance. So those are also things that are important to cities and towns.
Yes.
So yeah. I think that's part of what's behind it.
Yes, and I'm sure they're thinking they'll stand up better to the kids, the wear and tear on the kids. But I know firsthand, yeah. My first exposure with native plants is when my children were young. I helped start an outdoor classroom. Oh, I'm guessing. Oh, this is when they were in kindergarten, and now he's in grade 12. So an outdoor classroom, native space at their elementary school. And hindsight teaches me a lot. So we did go all native plants, but unfortunately we bought little teeny tiny plants. So that was, a mistake in hindsight. A few things did well and kind of toughed it out. But, in hindsight we should have, budget, of course, right?
Yeah.
So I'm sure when you're planning those types of things in cities and towns and larger parks, you're looking at larger scale plant material.
It's true. I mean, I think we think sometimes when we think of native plants, we think of that trillion that you've seen in the forest.
Yes.
And as beautiful as those are, and they really are sometimes very appropriate in the garden, they don't tend to do as well in that kind of urban park or that
right.
place that, like the school ground that has so many kids running around. So you just have to, you just have to, you know, pick your spots. And the same goes for your garden. I mean, if you have an area that, you know, you have kids and they always run around this one area, there are actually native plants you can choose that'll survive that. But trillium's probably not one of them.
Yes, for sure. For sure. So what type of, so we can talk a little bit about that for our average homeowners. Do you have any suggestions for, you know, those high traffic areas? I don't know. Are there plants that could actually be a lawn substitute?
Well, I think it depends. You know, I a lot of the time when I think of native plant gardening and getting people started on it, I tend to think of people's front yards.
Yes, okay.
You know, I don't know if you found that in your practice, but it tends to be an area that quite often people don't use as much.
Right.
They almost have it there more for their neighbors.
Mm-hmm, yep.
Looking good in front of their neighbors.
Yes.
Stuff like that. So you know, there's no question the lawn is, you know, great in so many ways if you're going to run around and kick a soccer ball and do that in the backyard. But in the front lawn, you know, I think there are some ground covers that can, you know, handle a few steps, you know, people walking through from time to time, but you know, not playing sports on them or anything.
Right.
So there are a few, you know, some of the ones that I've used in my garden, you know, I like foam flower, you know, Tiarella.
Yes.
It's a pretty tough ground cover plant that spreads, you know, fairly quickly without being, you know, invasive.
Okay.
And it has the bonus of Tiarella or foam flower is that it has this amazing show of white flowers in the spring.
Okay.
Really, like, very, very forceful, white, beautiful flowers that are really quite startling. And then, you know, after that, it actually just has a really handsome leaf, and it's only about, you know, a foot tall. And
okay.
It's related to, some people might have planted Hutera or Hutera.
Yes, yeah. So it's the same family.
It's the same family, yeah.
Okay.
It's just a North American native.
Oh, okay.
So that's a good one. And then one that's a little more grassy, which you don't see a lot of, but I think it will become more common, is Pennsylvania sedge.
Oh, that's a new one for me.
Yeah, it's a sedge, which is, you know, quite similar to a grass.
Okay.
A little bit botanically different, but it basically looks like a grass. It's kind of like a grass that grows about you know, a foot tall and then doesn't grow anymore.
Okay.
And it's kind of a clumping grass that will spread, but it'll do it slowly. And I think if your listeners look it up, you know, you'll see, you know, on the internet or wherever, you'll see that some people are starting to use it as this kind of wild grass that you can put under trees or replace a lawn with. And it looks like grass, but just a little bit wilder.
Okay. And it will go from full sun to full shade, or is it?
So the interesting thing about Pennsylvania sedge is it's a great shade plant.
Okay.
It can even handle the dry shade.
Oh, okay.
Which is always a struggle. So
yeah,
it's not good for like scorching sun. I would recommend different things for that, like creeping phlox or other plants. But for a semi shady, you know, under a tree or something in the front yard or backyard, those two, foam flower and Pennsylvania sedge, are good choices.
That's a great choice, because sometimes people can't even grow grass in those conditions. So. It's nice to know that there's always nice to know when there's an alternative.
That's true.
And that's that case. What are some of the plants in your garden that are your favorite?
Wow. Well, I have, you know, I purchased a house a few years ago, a new house, and have a, you know, a pretty decent sized garden. So I've been kind of not starting over, but trying new things. You
okay.
know? And you know, I mentioned a couple already. I use foam flower and Pennsylvania sedge. My garden's sort of half shade, so I've got a lot of Norway maples at the edges of my yard.
Yeah.
So the back half is quite shady, and I've used those two plants, and I also have a few others. There's one that I think people are familiar with is columbine. And the eastern columbine, I call it eastern columbine, is the native version, and it's got those great kind of dangly star shaped flowers.
Yes.
And they're red, and it's one of these plants that just keeps going.
Yeah.
It's it starts early and probably starts flowering by late May, and it's still going in early July. So I really enjoyed that one, and another one in the shady part is wild ginger. Wild ginger. There's a European ginger that's similar.
Okay.
But the Canadian, it's called actually Asarum canadensis. It's a Canadian or North American ginger. It's got like these big heart-shaped fleshy leaves.
And they're quite dramatic. I am familiar with those. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes people ask like, well, I really like hosta.
And
what can I do instead of a hosta? And I tend to recommend that one because it's not quite as big as some of the big hostas, but it's notable in the garden.
Yes.
And it's quite dense too. It'll fill an area and spread and has very small little flowers in the early spring, but it's mostly a foliage plant.
Right, right. Much like hosta. Yeah, I'd love any suggestions. I think I had that down on my list of questions for you. Other than, because I think I personally, I'm not super hosta, much of a super hosta fan. I mean, I think it's just been overused a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot. And I do appreciate the fact that dry shade, is a more challenging area, and they do well in dry shade. I have the customers that, full sun, honest to goodness, I put in a boxwood hedge and they go, well, no, I think I want to just line the whole walkway with hostas. And I'm like, yeah, well, that's not going to look too great in, many of the months of the year kind of thing. So I kind of fight that battle a little bit, people that love hosta, they love their hosta. But it's nice to know there's some alternatives and have them be native as well.
Yeah, I mean the other one that you've probably recommended is Solomon's Seal.
Yes, yeah.
That's a great plant. It's I'm amazed actually that I've seen it in the shade. I've seen it actually in a lot of sun, and it's also one of these plants that grows a little taller, so up to 3 feet. But like hostas, it has really interesting leaves and can kind of fill a spot under trees, and it's just very handsome with kind of arching branches and stalks. So that's another favorite of mine.
Yeah, it has a really nice texture in the garden.
It does.
I've used, now correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's a Canada anemone. Are you familiar with that one?
I am, yeah. Yeah, those are great. I don't know if you've used them, Joanne, but I've just started actually in the last few years, and they're kind of a plant that, again, I think we look for these kinds of plants in gardens, plants that can handle a lot of different circumstance.
Okay.
So, Canada, I've seen them in the wild, for instance, by, bogs or ponds.
Okay.
And they
more
can really
wet.
Handle.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, they can handle the wet.
Okay.
But the funny thing about those plants, the Canada anemone, is they can also deal with drought. So, they probably would rather be somewhere that's a little moister, but if they dry out, they're not one of these plants that's going to die immediately. So, and just to describe them for those that don't know, it's Canada anemones. People might be familiar with other ones, but they have little almost star-shaped white flowers with yellow centers, and also quite an interesting leaf, almost.
Yes.
I would say almost like a geranium leaf.
Yeah, but like a little frilly on the end.
That's right. That's right.
And yeah, definitely. And the flower I find a little bit almost like a larger strawberry plant.
Like, that's a great description.
Is that a
yeah.
good description? Yes.
Yeah.
And I did have them in a dry area. I had them under spruce trees.
There you go.
When nothing really grows. And Yeah, and they did do well there. So,
I mean, I would really recommend, you know, we're talking specific plants, and I would say, you know, some of these plants are great plants for people to get going with, because you know, they're, once you get, you know, past, you know, trying things out and you become a fanatic, like
right,
some of us have become.
Yeah.
You know, you can start to experiment with these very complex little woodland flowers.
But yeah,
some of the ones we're talking about, you know, the tiarellas and the flowering dogwoods and the Canada anemones, I mean, those are plants that really anyone can grow.
Yes.
And then can kind of start to enjoy immediately and get their hands dirty.
Okay. Well, we've talked about little ones. Now, what about plants that can make a bigger statement? You know, you mentioned you have Norway maples in your yard, and I know we were encouraging customers not to plant any more Norway maples.
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
Yeah, no,
yeah.
I would agree.
Yeah, aren't they? Have they been officially classified as a weed or as an invasive?
Yeah, they are in
okay.
a lot of jurisdictions.
Yeah,
they're very invasive, and it's one of these things, you know, and a plant sometimes does too well in its new environment, and Norway maples really are one of those plants that just forces out. You know, we have a really dedicated member in our association, our society, NAMPS, named John Boydall, and he calls the Norway maple the Death Star tree, because it just smothers everything around
it.
And it's a good description.
Yeah, and they get so big. Oh, so I want to talk a little bit more about some other choices instead of the Norway maple, but we'll talk about that in just a moment when we get back from commercial break. Thank you, Miles. Hold on the line. And thank you. You're listening to Joanne Shaw on Down the Garden Path on Reality Radio 101. I get kicked in the face, feel like I'll back for more. But I won't cry no more, because the tears are all in vain. We can pick up the pieces and start it all again.
In Napoli, where love is king, when boy meets girl, here's what they say.
When the moon hits.
Are you craving real, authentic Italian food? Then crave no more. At Sina's Kitchen, you can experience the absolute best in authentic Italian food cuisine. How about a delicious veal or chicken sandwich on a bun? Or actual homemade lasagna and scrumptious soups? No time to prepare and cook a meal? Then try one of Sina's amazing frozen dinners that taste just as great as they look. At Sina's Kitchen, we do not fry our food, guaranteeing you the most delicious and healthy food available, bar none. We offer just 100% authentic Italian delicacies, made daily right in front of your eyes. Come by Sina's Kitchen, located at 140 Simcoe Street South, at the corner of John Street and downtown Oshawa. Plenty of free parking in the rear. Remember, Sina's Kitchen will also cater all of your very special needs and events. Don't cook tonight. Just call Sina's Kitchen at 289-939-3383. That's 289-939-3383. Remember, Sina's Kitchen. Now that's amore.
That's amore.
When you visit Peacock Lumber, you will step back in time to a place where purchasing wood products was simple, efficient, and pleasant. In our office, you can view our large selection of moldings and receive advice from knowledgeable sales staff. Once you have decided on your order, you can pick up your materials in our drive-through yard or utilize our delivery service. For pickups, take your vehicle out to our traditional lumber yard, where someone is always there to assist you. If you are accustomed to purchasing wood products at a box store, you will be impressed by the variety, selection, and quality of products that we offer, and the ease in which you get your vehicle loaded and get you on your way. Peacock Lumber is conveniently located on 8 acres in central Oshawa. It was started in 1939 by Victor Peacock and remains family-owned and operated. If you need quality wood products for your renovation, please call us at 905-725-4744. That's 905-725-4744. Or for a full list of products and prices, go to www.peacocklumber.ca. Come to Peacock Lumber first to get the price, selection, quality, and service that you expect.
Welcome back to Down the Garden Path with your host, Joanne Shaw, right here on Reality Radio 101. To contact Joanne, send her an email right now, realityradio101@yahoo.com. And now, back to your host of Down the Garden Path, Joanne Shaw.
Welcome back. Welcome back, Miles.
Hello.
Had a nice classic rock that Gary plays for us there.
Love it.
So we were talking about the Norway maple and how we're recommending to our customers no longer to plant it. But shade trees are an important part of the garden and one of the, you know, big request for me personally. What are some of your recommendations for a nice size shade tree?
Oh boy! Well, there are there's a lot to choose from.
Okay.
A lot of great native shade trees out there. One of the best, I think, as a replacement if someone's used to Norway maples, obviously, is the native equivalent, which is really the red maple.
Okay.
So I think you got to be careful sometimes with the names, but the botanical name is Acer rubrum, and it's a great tree. You know, it's it has a lot of the things that a lot of the good things about Norway maples. It can handle dry or wet, and it's a really nice shape.
Okay.
But it has things that the Norway maple doesn't, which is it's native, which is what we want, but also really great fall color. It's a real consistent performer.
Okay, so the red is at fall time. It's not to be confused with the red-leaved Crimson King, which is also a Norway maple.
Yeah,
correct.
Very important
okay,
point.
Okay.
Exactly.
I know I should have the botanical names rolling off my tongue. I apologize, but
no. It's, you know, when you get to the nursery, it's really sometimes it's confusing. There's so many names, and it's one sometimes good to just have the odd botanical name in your pocket.
Yes, for sure. So the red maple is not a red-leafed maple, but it does have a beautiful red fall color.
That's exactly right.
Perfect.
Another great tree, I would say, is the red oak.
Okay.
And the reason for that is it's a great shade tree. It's just very elegant, you know, another big kind of shade tree. But as I think I mentioned earlier, it's also one of the most important trees from a habitat standpoint. And bar none, you know, it's about three times, it has three times as many species as almost any other tree. And I'm talking about insects. And
yes,
birds,
not raccoons and all the other annoying things, right?
No. Things we want in our garden.
That's right. That's good. Now, how about something I have to admit, you know, my suburban lots that I do out here in the suburbs are smaller, you know, 30, 40 feet wide. And so I tend to try to find a tree. I mean, as much as it's a shade tree, but to find trees that aren't as big. So I don't know. I guess they're not really shade trees, but they're just nice trees. I use the service berry. I use it as a multi-stemmed as well as a tree form. Are there other trees? You know, that tends to be about a 20-foot tree, right?
It does. I mean, it can, like you said, it has different forms. And
right.
Depending on the situation, it can grow different heights. But it's about, it's about a 20, especially in the sun, it's about a 20-foot tree.
Right.
That's a great one. You know, I have to say that's like I think maybe my favorite.
Yeah, mine too.
And it's I think the reason, if people aren't as familiar with it, is it's just like the perfect tree. I mean, it has mm-hmm. it has the spring flower show, kind
yeah.
of these white, you know, really beautiful scented flowers. In the summer, it has edible fruit.
Yeah.
Which you literally can make jams from, and they're kind of like blueberries.
Yes, if the birds don't beat you to it.
You're right, they love it. So if you can beat them to it, yeah, you're gonna pie out of it. But they also, and then the beautiful thing is that, and then in the fall, they're one of the nicest fall-colored shrubs or small trees out there.
Yes.
And the leaves don't hold maybe as long as some others, but
right.
They can be bright reds and oranges, and so, you know, that's kind of, I think we all look for something that can perform like that through the season.
For sure, for sure. So I was hoping you had another one for me, so I can...
I'll give you one more.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, and I think people actually know this one because I'm seeing it in the nursery so much more.
Oh, okay.
That's redbud.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, which is a very unique
yes.
native small tree, and the people probably know it from its early spring flowers.
Right.
And they come out in these, I don't know, I'd call it maybe like a rosy purple spring flower that comes out even before any of the leaves.
Right.
And so it's kind of like I don't know what you think, Joanna. I find it like almost like a Japanese cherry tree or
yes,
something.
Yes, yeah, very much so. And when it does leaf out, it's got those big heart-shaped leaves.
It does.
So right.
It really changes through the year. So you'll get, you know, these little blossoms early in the spring, this really beautiful arched form. And then later on, you get a tree that has actually some shade-giving potential as well. So, and those big heart-shaped leaves, yeah.
Now, zone-wise, I think I've had some customers who have had a hard time growing it. I think our late, you know, when we get, because it blooms so early, that or they lose the bloom, which we risk, you know, with, you know, even forsythia, right? If we get that late hard frost,
true.
You know, that's can be one of the problems with it. But definitely, I think it wasn't around in the nurseries. I know when I was working in the nurseries, it was very rare to see one. But, you know, I know the last couple of years, I agree, it's definitely been around more.
Yeah, and I think it's a good point you make about the frost. What I would say is if someone's going to put it in their yard, try to find just a little bit more of a sheltered location.
Yeah, protected.
It's not going to be as good, you know, further up, let's say, in the zones that are, you know, like northern Ontario.
Yeah.
It might be a good choice. But in the southern, you know, regions, the northern states, northeastern states, and the kind of southern Ontario region, it should, in a sheltered location, it should be okay.
Excellent. Excellent. So, serviceberry, red bud. How about we've neglected the poor evergreens? So, my favorite is a hemlock. What about you? Do you have some other recommendations? I mean, I know everybody loves their spruce tree. I mean, but I think I'm less familiar with which ones are native and which ones aren't as far as the evergreens.
Yeah, it can get a bit confusing because, you know, the evergreens are something that are hybridized a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so many versions of different trees, and they grow them for their different shapes and colors and all sorts of stuff. So, there are several good native evergreens, and I agree with you. The hemlock is a really graceful tree. It's the eastern hemlock is the native hemlock.
Right.
And that's a great tree. It's, you know, it depends where you live. You know, it doesn't do necessarily as well in a city as it would, you know, a little bit away from the pollution.
Oh, okay.
But it'll I think it's still worth trying no matter what. It's,
yeah.
It's one of those trees that can really find its spot. But the other ones, you know, the native spruce, there's a couple, there's three, but the white spruce, Picea glauca. That's a really good spruce tree. So if you kind of, you know, I know some people like the Colorado blue spruce.
Right.
But I find that a bit out of place. It's a mountain tree, and people tend to put it in their landscapes.
Yeah.
And to me, it looks like it doesn't really belong.
Yeah.
And the white spruce, however, is a tough tree. Like it can handle the wet, it can handle the dry, and it's, you know, Christmas tree, cone-shaped tree. It's a pretty good tree. I mean, you have to remember most of the native evergreens do get pretty big.
Yes.
But the white spruce is a good one, and then of course pine trees. You
yeah,
know,
pine
they
trees.
They don't do as well in the city, but if you're just away from the kind of the most polluted parts of the city, you know, the red and white pines both do fairly well, and they're just the kind of quintessential look. Especially the white pine.
Yeah, they really are, and just in the winter, that's just when you really get to notice them. They really stand out, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, spruce and pine, and to be honest, there is another native that I think people should pay more attention
to,
and that's the eastern red cedar.
Okay.
It's classed as a juniper, but it's what we call a red cedar.
Okay.
In the northeast of North America, so it's kind of a narrow plant. So you know, people often use evergreens as a hedge.
Yes.
And it's a pretty good one. It's
so you could make this into a hedge.
You can make it into a hedge.
Okay.
Or you can just have it on a fence line, and it grows fairly upright. And it's about a third as wide as it is tall at the end of the day.
Okay. So a better choice than the emerald cedars?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it is. It's definitely better for the environment.
Yeah.
And I'm getting a little tired of seeing emerald cedars.
Yeah, me too.
A bit too predictable.
Yeah. And with there's so many that are being flooded in the market, like the, you know, the ones that aren't really grown around here. And so I find customers, you know, they try to plant a hedge and then every year two different plants die, right?
Yeah.
So I try to educate. It's really important to buy plants that are grown here, nurseries here versus shipped in from, you know, far, far away in other climates like BC, right?
You're very right. That's really important.
Yeah, and some of the big box stores, they're selling them for, you know, very economical prices. And if you look at them, they're planted in sand, you know, or hard clay.
Mm-hmm.
They're really not going to do well. So, you know, not to knock anybody, but you get what you pay for when it comes to plants, right?
Yeah, anytime you see a plant everywhere, you're likely not going to get a great version of it.
That's right. That's right. Well, I thank you so much, Miles. I think we've covered quite a bit, and I've learned a lot. I've been taking notes. I hope my listeners have been taking notes as well.
It's a pleasure. No, it's really fun talking about gardens when it's cold outside.
That's right. That's right. When it's full of snow.
Yes.
Do you want to, by the way, because we got quite a few people listening to you, Miles, you want to plug anything?
Oh, yes. Tell us a bit more about the Native Plant Society or anything you have going on.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm happy to talk a little bit more about the Native Plants, North American Native Plant Society. You know, if people are getting interested in native plants, you know, our website, which is www.nanps, which is NANPS.org, is a great resource.
Okay.
You know, we're a charitable, nonprofit organization, and really the mission, you know, that NANPS has is simply to promote and to help preserve and restore the native flora of North America, and the way we do that is through education.
Okay.
So helping, you know, native, or I should say, residential, you know, gardeners. To give them resources so that they can learn more about native plants and start to garden with them.
Excellent. And I noticed you have a good Facebook page as well.
We do.
Where you list a lot of the events.
Yeah, look us up. It's you know, we do lots of events and talks, and it's just something you can find in your community and hopefully get more involved with native planting.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah, I found the Facebook page very informative, and I know our listeners are all over the U.S. and Southern Ontario, so I'm sure there's an event near you. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Joanne.
You're welcome. Thank you, Miles, very much. And you have a good evening.
Yeah, enjoy the garden talk.
Thanks, I will. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, thank you very much, everyone. I hope you enjoyed listening to Down the Garden Path today as much as I did, listening to Miles McKenzie talk about native plants and all of our should and shouldn't do's in the gardens. And I'm really looking forward to this upcoming season, helping my customers try to incorporate some of these plants into their home, their yards. So thank you very, very much. And I want to thank you for listening to Down the Garden Path here on Reality Radio 101. Now, there's no show next week, right, Gary? So I didn't go anywhere. There will be no show on Family Day or President's Day, I believe, in the U.S. on February 17th. But we'll see you back here on February 23rd. So thank you, and stay warm. And we'll join you down the garden path. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Down the Garden Path with your host, Joanne Shaw, right here on Reality Radio 101.